Okay, so gamma ray burst fireballs with neutrons. Okay, so I will start my talk with a brief introduction on gamma ray bursts, just one slide to fix ideas. Then I want to go with you through the arguments that. Do you have a point?
Is there a point?
Question? Okay, sorry. So I want to go with you through the arguments that lead us to think that gamma ray burst fireballs, if baryons are present at all, they contain neutrons. And here I will make a link, so between the engine that produces gamma ray bursts of the disk and the gamma ray burst jet. And then this will set the stage for the main argument of the talk, which is how the baryon content of gamma ray burst fireball affects its dynamic and thermodynamics. And then I will go to conclusions. Okay, so gamma ray burst theory basically addresses three questions, three issues, intimately related to three phases of the jet evolutions. So how the jet is produced and powered, so the question on the engine. How gamma rays are produced, and this is related to this early evolution of the jet, where the interaction with the ambient medium is an important. And what we think is that these gamma rays tell us something about the plasma condition at in the jet. The third question is what produces the light curve in the afterglow phase, what we call afterglow. And this is related to the third phase of the jet evolution, where the jet, the interaction with the external medium decelerates the jet, and probably the what we see is the result of the shocked interstellar medium. So the afterglow, the electrons say the acceleration, the emission site for the afterglow is the external medium. That's what we think, while the acceleration, the emission site for the prompt emission is the fireball itself. We have a lot of data for this phase, for the afterglow phase. This phase is much less constrained, and we have only clues for the engine. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to concentrate on this least understood two first phases. So in the first part, I will try to show you what we think is going on here. And then, which is the main part of the talk, we'll consider this early phase of the evolution of the jet.
Just a quick question on the scales. Is anything maybe a little bit on the low side?
No, this is no way. This scale is basically the radius for internal shock to take place.
You wrote an expression there.
Take place.
This R, the original R would be something of order C delta T. Delta T would be like at least a second for long bursts.
No,
what?
Millisecond.
The millisecond is the variability time scale. This is the size of the shell. So, okay. So the engine. The bottom line of this first part of the talk will be the following, so that current engine models seem to naturally predict neutron-loaded fireballs. Okay, so why? Why I can make such a general statement? Because any model for the engines that we have now basically involve the formation of a black hole, a newly born black hole, surrounded by an accretion disk of comparable mass, fusilla masses. Regardless how this black hole and accretion disk were formed in the first place. So basically the engines that have been proposed are a collapser of a massive star, merger of neutron star, merger of compact objects like a neutron star, black holes, and you can play with it. But the result, the final result, is that we have an hyper-accreting disks. So, and with accretion rate of the order of, say, one solar mass per second. So one can go and basically study the general property of these accretion disks. And this was what Andrei has done. So these are density and temperature, and these are the contour for this parameter Ye, which is basically the proton over nucleon fraction. So this calculation is the calculation of the nuclear composition at equilibrium in the disk. And when this parameter is lower than 0.5, we are dominated by protons. When it's lower than 0.5, we are dominated by neutrons. This part in protons and neutrons are in nuclei, while here they are free. And one can go and study the conditions in the inner part, most part of this hyperaccreting disk. And for the range of density and temperature in this inner part, it turns out that we are in this region. So the innermost part of this disk are dominated by free baryons. And neutrons are present, and in fact, they dominate. And this is general, and this has been done in the context of the collapser model. So basically, the disk has been the black hole comes from the collapse of the nucleus of the star, while the accretion disk is fed by the remaining star, which accretes onto the black hole. And again, we have the same result, that this parameter is in the innermost part of the disk is less than 0.5. So we are neutron rich. And this parameter is the fraction of free baryons over.
What alpha and beta?
What
parameter of the accretion?
This one. Is for an accretion flow of I think 0.1 solar mass per second. Okay, and again we see that the innermost part, this is radius, innermost part of the disk, we are dominated by free baryons, most of which are neutrons. Okay, so gamma burst jets are born in neutron-rich environment, but are these jets neutron-rich? So basically, the nuclear composition of the jet reflects the neutral composition of the disk. Okay, so here we should take into account time scales, basically. So what happens is that the material here is in a very dense and hot environment. And basically, is extracted, picked up by the jet, and the transition is from a dense and hot environment to a less dense environment. If it had enough time to adjust to equilibrium, this matter would deneutralize, right? Because we are going basically we are going from here to here.
Do you have any idea what the baryon loading is of a GRB jet? How many baryons?
Yeah, we have an idea, but it's just an observational constraint, basically. So it should be something like 10 to the minus 4 or 5 solar mass.
Maximum.
Okay. But so we were here. We weren't trying to make a neutral rich jet. Okay? So what we should compare is the escape time scale with the neutralization time scale, which is the time scale for positron, basically positron capture or a neutrino absorption. And what it turns out is that if you take as the escape time scale, the turbulent time scale, so say the Keplerian time scale, and you compare with the neutralization time scale, you have that this time scale is larger. It means that the meta is taken from here and is picked up from the surface of the disk without changing the composition. So at the base of a jet, we have a nuclear composition which reflects the nuclear composition in the disk. Then the jets start expanding, and so the fibers start expanding, and like in the Big Bang, we have nucleosynthesis. But since the parameter in the gamma burst fiber are different from the parameter in the Big Bang, we have that nucleosynthesis is only marginally successful. And so what we are left is that a fiber with most of the baryons free, and with excess of neutrons.
The statement about the composition of jet being the same as that of the disk, I guess, that is that, for example, if you had magnetic fields which were driving the jet, maybe it would be different, I guess.
Yeah, I think, okay, so as far as I understand this, is okay, this is the simplest calculation you can do, right? Because the unknown, the big unknown, I think, is the escape time scale, so the turbulent time scale. Okay? So you are asking me, what if this time scale is not a Keplerian time scale, but something else?
You could also just be asking, what's pushing the neutrons out?
Hmm? Yeah, which is this time scale.
To the protons.
Yeah. By elastic scale. Mm-hmm. You are asking if you can extract only protons and no, in this you, so. Exactly. Can you so?
I guess it was more generally. I mean, if, for example, you needed a field to lift something up out of the disk, then the neutrons wouldn't be necessarily coupled.
No, it's the density is so high that you are collisionally coupled. Strong collision,
yes.
Coupled neutrons and protons.
What's the density in this region?
Yeah.
Grams
per centimeter square.
It's not a pulsar.
No. No. And
so this, I mean, the axis has no angular momentum support and such, so isn't kind of stuff be. I mean, you could have, there's also the terror issue, paraplasmas.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if the core along the black hole was somehow evacuating, and you're
getting
your jet from that region, not from the, I don't know. Well,
when you say composition, you only mean N over P.
Yeah.
So you can have lots of pairs.
You do have pairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just interject the clarification? I will think so.
Yes.
This picture is somewhat misleadingly drawn compared to what Elena is talking about. The jet that she's talking about comes from the disk. And
yeah.
There, if you have magnetic driving or electromagnetic driving, it's always the same.
Yeah,
you push on
yeah.
the charge components and like that.
Yeah.
The other picture is that you actually do go along the fan, which is what Amir and Hector investigated, and there you possibly have very little there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about. Okay. Meta picked up from the surface of the disk here. Okay.
Is it clear, this is perhaps a way too high order question for the people who are doing these things, is it clear that the surface of the disk has got the same number P as the insides?
No, probably they have not, I mean, for sure, because the density drops, right? So here the temperature, the density drops. So if you take some matter here and you give to it enough time to go to do like a thermodynamical transformation in equilibrium, this meta would change N over P. What my argument here is that you don't have enough time to do this transformation in equilibrium. So the meta from.
That I got stuff, if I did have to get stuff from the inside to the other, the assumption that the the turbulent transport time of a fluid element from the inside to the outside is just the orbital time.
Yes.
Let me clarify that. I mean, it may be either turbulent or it can be just an irregular outflow type model. I mean, it can be just a steady state, quasi steady state.
But you need to take.
An outflow will come from the surface of the disk.
Yes, but you need.
Supply the surface of the disk, if you do.
No. It would come from the. It would be a flow line to move in. And eventually would reach the surface, but initially would not be at the surface.
The time
scale is always about the sum plus
you're
the time.
To a different question.
Yeah.
The time scale is always about the sum plus and time of the vertical scale height, which is about the dynamical.
I think it depends on the. For the turbulent time scale that you assume, okay? Okay. Okay. Yes. Exactly. Okay. Set the stage, and you say, okay, we are not crazy to put neutrons into fireballs. Okay. If you want to argue more details, you go to that guy over there. You ask him precisely, right? Because
So we know this. unless we go to the radical transport, but if you use the standard model of viscous transport,
yes,
and we do know that there is turbulence, so we do know that that mixed by turbulence, we know the time scale of these turbulence.
This is the best you can.
So, in order for a given element of material to go slowly to the surface, so slowly that you can adjust to the new chemical, to the new chemical composition. Now this motion should be really gentle, much, much slower than the sound speed. Orders of magnitude slower than the sound speed.
Okay, so for characteristic temperature and density, you are Newton on this.
Is it clear what is the stability of this space?
The stability?
Yeah, I mean, so how
they are stable, because we do see gamma bursts. Okay, no, sorry, but the what were you worried about? The cooling?
No, I'm worried about the how long you need that your disk will be.
For the duration of a burst, so few seconds.
Very, very, very short. Okay.
Yes. But I think they are stable. Exactly.
Specific evidence for neutrons in the observation.
Exactly. But I think they are stable because 10 seconds.
Okay, this is degenerating a little bit too much. It's great to have discussion, but that's can be focused back in on the talk.
Okay. So So of course So here the question, the problem we wanted to address, we ask ourselves, is that, so if neutrons are likely to be there, how this would change the standard picture that we have in mind in gamma ray burst? Because in gamma ray burst, it has always been assumed that fireballs are loaded only if baryons are there, they are only protons. Okay? So we ask ourselves how the presence of neutrons affect gamma ray burst fireballs. Okay, so basically we are working in the more standard framework. So the internal energy of this fireball are actually only radiation. Okay, no magnetic field, and this is because we want to concentrate on the physical mechanism, the physical phenomenon that are triggered by the presence of neutrons. So once we have listed and worked out this phenomena, then you can elaborate on it. You can complicate, you can put magnetic field, but the claim is that once we have identified which are the consequences of neutrons, these phenomena remain there even if magnetic field is present. Of course, quantitative, the result will be different. So Lorentz vector, for instance, with radio will be different, the temperature will be different, but we do will have heating, do we have deceleration, as I'm going to show you in a minute.
So what you're doing, magnetic field should not matter for the temperature.
No.
I'm saying, it's, I agree with you.
Yeah, exactly. So, so we have an outflow with protons, electrons, radiation, and neutrons. Pairs are present at the beginning, but after after 50 times the initial radius, they become dynamically unimportant. So I will neglect them for the following. Okay, and now I'm listed which are the main interaction between all these pieces that take place in the flow. So we have the radiation. Radiation interact with electron by Compton scattering, and this will be the source of acceleration. Electron interact with protons, of course, and vice versa, by Coulomb collision. And the standard picture in gamma ray burst theory usually ends here. And now we have these two processes that become important. So at the beginning, the density is very high, and a strong collision, inelastic collision, becomes important between protons and neutrons. But neutrons also beta decay into protons. And we will have that the proton that come from the beta decay will interact with the original proton. And I will show in a minute this is a source of energy dissipation. So since these two ingredients are new, I'll go into more detail.
What is the last line
for? I'm going to describe it anyway more in detail. So the first process that is new, so strong collision between neutrons and protons. Here we are in the rest frame of the neutron. This is its cross-section. And what's happened is that the radiation accelerate protons via electron, okay? And proton acquire a relative velocity with respect to neutrons that do not interact directly with radiations. And this relative velocity is a source of momentum exchange, so an accelerating force and heating. Okay, you can ask yourself how many scattering per second a neutron undertake, and which is the mean momentum exchange per collision. And under the assumption of isotropic scattering, you have that the force that a neutron feels is the following. And with the Lorentz transformation, we can have a relation between the Lorentz vector of neutron and the Lorentz vector of proton, okay? But but what you should take out from here is the following, that the relative velocity between neutrons and protons increases as the fireball expands and increases as the ratio of the collisional time scale over the dynamical time scale. So when the collisional time scale is shorter than the dynamical time scale, the relative velocity is non-relativistic, it's less than c. When the time scale for collision equal the dynamical time scale, which is the expansion time scale, then you have that neutrons and protons acquire a relativistic velocity energy. Okay. But there is another process, another source of heating, which is triggered by the beta decay. Actually, neutrons continuously beta decay into proton. And this set the condition for the two-stream instability to develop. In fact, we have a background plasma, which are given by the original neutron. This is the lab frame, so everything go. So this is the background plasma, and then you have a bin of protons that comes from the beta decay that move relative to the background plasma. And so the two-stream instability in the absence of magnetic field is the shorter mechanism that we have. So the two-stream instability in the plasma timescale redistributes energy and momentum. And what you have is a source of heating, and as we and we'll see, of deceleration. But I will be maybe more clear later. Deceleration and heating because neutrons, we'll see, will be slower than proton. So it's like injecting slow proton into a stream of fast proton. So what you have is that they are slowed down by this continuous injection of slow proton. Yeah.
What is the ratio actually between neutrons and protons at the initial stage?
Yeah, it's a parameter. But so can be. I think I will show you some example with the ratio equal 10, but one is enough.
The
yes. Yeah. But it's a parameter, so I will show you what's happening if you increase or decrease this ratio.
Is the bulk motion it's much larger than the random motion?
Yes. Okay, but only one technical slide, and then we go to the result. So, but how we actually solve the problem? We have 8 unknown, and we need 8 coupled equations. So what we do is to start from some initial conditions. So we have a size of the region where the energy is released, the initial size, which in our case is something like 10 to the 7 centimeter. Then we have some energy injected there, which for gamma ray burst is something like 10 to the 33 erg. We have some metal loading and the fraction of neutron of a proton. Given this initial condition, we see how it evolves, solving using the energy conservation, the mass conservation. Then we need a relation between protons and neutrons, and this is given by the beta decay law, of course. And then we need a relation between the Lorentz factor of neutron and protons. And the one I showed you before is given by the accelerating force that protons exert on neutrons. And finally, we should conserve the internal energy for each species. So we solved the dynamics and the thermodynamic coupled.
And what are the standards for energy conservation?
This is the stress and energy tensor, actually, the first.
There's a
diaphragm? No, this should be R. Yeah, sorry, it's the flux. Yeah. Yeah, this is the stress energy tensor, and this is the flux, the max flux vector.
So, what's new then?
Hmm?
What's new?
This is just summing over the components. So we have time, we have radius, we have zero, we have zero, because we solve in spherical coordinates.
So what's mass conservation?
It's a type on this.
Yeah.
Mass conservation is a scale equation.
It's a type.
This is a vector. You want me to write down? So. So. Okay.
Can I ask you, in each species, you assume thermal internal distribution?
Sorry?
For the protons and neutrons, they each are like a Maxwellian at a certain, at their given temperature?
Yeah, actually, yes. What we do is. Yes.
One more question on this, technical on this. Do you take into account also thermal coupling between the protons and the neutrons?
No. No. And this is because, because protons and neutrons, as long as they are coupled, okay, have the same temperature. Okay? When they couple, neutrons are no longer a fluid, right? So you cannot treat as temperature and have thermal decoupled. And the collision becomes very rare, right? Because they are decoupled. So we take into account only, so that's why.
Well, there have been statements in the literature that you probably will tell us about them or know that, in fact, after the decoupling, there is heating of the neutrons by this relative collisions, even if they are rare.
Mm-hmm. But I take into account heating by collisions all over the evolution.
Right. So, but the heating by the collision basically employs the same microphysical thermodynamics as the thermal coupling. It's still relative collisions of protons and neutrons mm-hmm. that transport both momentum and energy.
Yes.
So, in principle,
yes.
I'm wondering whether the thermal coupling should still be an issue.
No. I think that to have thermocoupling, maybe we are talking about two different things, I don't know. So this dq, okay, so heating in protons, mm-hmm. okay? So the two sources of heating for protons are given by basically the relative velocity of protons and neutrons, or proton and beta decay neutrons. Okay, is the relative velocity, and we do take into account it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The same collisions that heat the protons would also heat the neutrons.
Yes.
In principle, you
yes.
can imagine that there for the thermal, and since the protons could in principle cool, there may be
the proton could in principle. Coupled
by Coulomb collisions to the electrons, which then can radiate.
So before, when they are coupled, they basically have the same temperature, okay? So the only heating that is here is given by the relative velocity. Okay, this is the mean.
Okay, fine, I just wanted to know, but I'm just suggesting we can think later whether thermal coupling after the coupling.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay. One more question. Could you comment first line? What means the accelerating force of ion neutron? Relationship between a Lorentz factor of neutron as a function of
the Lorentz factor of protons.
So it means that it does not depend on the relative density on mass and health.
Yeah, I showed you before. Maybe it was too far. Here. So is this one? So the mean momentum gain per neutron. Sorry. Is basically the number of collision per second mm-hmm. times the mean momentum per collision. And so it depends on the density, depends on the relative velocity, depends on the cross section.
But this is force.
Yes.
This is real force. But you yes. write that there is just simple relationship between Lorentz factor of neutron.
Is this one? Then you go from the neutron proton from the neutron frame to the lab frame with the Lorentz transformation, and you can find how the Lorentz factor of neutrons evolve as the relative velocity between neutrons and protons changes.
I think the issue is it's not just a function of the Lorentz factor. I think he took.
Yeah, it's a density here.
Yeah, functional literally. Eleanor, on your next slide, if you put your next slide up.
Yeah. Next.
Keep going.
What is?
He took statement four as literally a symbolic relationship. He took it as a real equation.
Just to say that we need a relation to solve. Okay.
That's the result of integrating your transfer momentum from protons to neutrons.
Yes. Was F like a function of various things? Okay.
Also, how long you're integrated. You know, it's how much you get depends on how much time the neutrons are exposed to this accelerating force.
Yes, but this depends on the time scale. Okay, so results. Actually, here is what I'm showing here is when I switch off the neutrons. So this is the standard gamma ray burst fireball, as we learn. So this is back to early 1990s, Ries. basically.
Prehistory.
So, yeah.
Prehistory according to reason.
Yeah. Exactly. Not reason. So what we have is that, okay. So what we have the Lorentz vector and radius. Temperature and radius. Okay? So at the beginning, you inject a lot of energy in a very small volume. Okay? So this fiber is bound to expand. And we have that radiation accelerate protons via electron, and the radiation is in the absence of magnetic field is linear. Protons keep being accelerated until all the internal energy is transferred to bulk energy for protons. When I have no longer internal energy, protons start coasting with a constant Lorentz vector. Okay, and what happens here is just that as long as the fiber is optically thick, protons, electrons, and radiation cools down for adiabatic expansion as a relativistic fluid. So the temperature is controlled by radiation that dominates pressure and energy. When the fiber becomes transparent, we have that protons and electrons decouple from radiation and start cooling for adiabatic expansion under their own pressure. The picture we have learned is that for most of the time, the fireball is a cold coasting outflow. And what we think is that somewhere around here, something happens and we have gamma rays emission. Okay.
Could you predict light curve?
No, because it depends on the emission mechanism. Here I'm doing only the dynamic and the thermodynamic. But you should assume an emission mechanism. Synchrotron, Compton, synchrotron sub Compton, and then on the top of that, you should add something that I don't have here, which is some kind of modulation of the flow. Because what we see in gamma burst light curves is they are very variable and spiky.
But for me, it seems strange because you have already photons, yeah?
But basically, after this radius.
But when it becomes optically thin.
Yeah, what you. Yes. You can. But what you have here after this, you have that maybe some radiation has remained there, this radiation, and you have freely streaming photons. But what you observe, you can calculate, is thermal radiation, and what we observed is non-thermal radiation. So it means that this cannot be also because it's not consistent with the with what we observed. Is not what we observed.
Also, the thermal radiation is also rather low energy by this time.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't finished it. I wanted to say, oh, sorry. Also, because it is not the right temperature, is not what we observed.
This is just conical also.
This is spherical.
Yes.
Sorry? This is the photosphere. This is the saturation radius where most of the energy, here most of the energy is in radiation. Here most of the energy is in protons, in kinetic energy of protons. And this is the decoupling radius for electrons and the radiation. Okay. So this is the picture. And now we had neutron. Okay, so, and here is the result. It's different. So, it was worth, right? Okay, let's try to be clear. Again, Lorentz vector on radius, temperature, and radius. Okay, what's happened here is that at the beginning we have a very high density. The density here is 10 to the 27 particle per centimeter cube. Okay, So what's happened is that neutrons and protons are really coupled, and they accelerate at the same rate until the timescale for collision becomes of the order of the dynamical timescale. So neutrons cannot be longer be accelerated by protons. So they start decouple from the flow and start coasting, while protons keep being accelerated by radiation. And when all the radiation has been transported to bulk kinetic energy for proton, also protons start coasting. Let's stop here and see what's happened to the temperature. Okay. Okay. So here, as long as the density is very high and protons and neutrons are coupled, the relative velocity is small. Okay. So the heating by collision is lower than the cooling by than the adiabatic cooling. So what's happened here is simply that all the components cool down for adiabatic expansion. At this point, the heating by collision becomes dominates the adiabatic cooling, and the temperature of proton start increasing. Okay.
Remind me, the protons actually were a small constituent by number compared to the neutrons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because
Yes, in here, but we observe this also when the neutron reaches is one. I will show that this goes down as you decrease this, of course.
Oh, okay, good, and I understand.
Yeah.
The temperature in the co-moving frame, or
in the resonance? Yes, the temperature is the co-moving frame. This is slab. This is its co-moving temperature. Yes. Okay.
Why the temperature of electrons is so
low? Okay, exactly. So what's happened is that the electron until here are coupled with radiation by Coulomb scattering. They are still coupled with radiation, but they feel the protons hitting them. So, okay.
Between the two simulations, the total density was kept the same, mass density.
I don't remember. Yes. Okay.
Why at some moment the temperature of radiation becomes constant? What happens?
This is the photosphere.
When
the flow becomes transparent, and so radiation can escape. As you see here, I don't treat carefully the transition, okay? Because
in this case, it happens. It seems much closer. Yes.
Well.
Now it happens at the distant end of the time.
Yeah? Because what's happened is that if you increase the number of protons relative to the number of neutrons relative to protons, mm-hmm. you decrease the number of electrons, mm-hmm. so you have less opacity, mm-hmm. so you start being become transparent earlier.
Yes.
That's what. Okay.
So what's happened to the
neutrons? Okay. So the neutron are is not plotted here because. Okay, I don't calculate it, but we know how they work. So basically, neutrons have the same temperature as protons until here, when they decouple.
And during the low temperature phase, you don't get significant fusion going on between neutrons and protons?
No, but the relative velocity is non-relativistic until there. Fusion, you pion production, you mean? Oh, well. Okay, so you have nucleosynthesis. Yes, you have nucleosynthesis until around here.
Right.
And then
you don't have none of it to matter. So
no.
Of
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
If you have successful nucleosynthesis, so you do the whole nucleosynthesis,
even if
the scale of correction is shorter than the expansion time scale, which could be if you have correlation with the conical outflow. In that case, you still have neutrons surviving because you have more neutrons.
You started with.
No,
okay.
Right. Okay. And
so. Okay. Yes.
Just to follow up on what Omar was asking, related to my previous question, there has been claims in the literature which I think are not right. There have been counterclaims, but Dereshev and collaborators came out and said that during the decoupling, the neutrons are going to be heated to very high temperatures, and because of their own relative temperatures, these neutrons will collide with each other. Not only the same process that inelastic collisions transform themselves into problems. So when you leave the decoupling region by this argument, which I think is wrong, but that's the point, you will have a neutron to proton ratio problem.
No. Okay, so what's happened here is the following. Okay, so when you arrive here, the relative, which this is the decoupling radius, okay, only here you start having enough energy and the right cross section, okay, for the inelastic collision to become important, okay, but only here. So you have one collision in a dynamical time scale, and that's it. And then you start having few collisions. What's happened here? That here you can have neutron-neutron interaction, proton-proton interaction, neutron-proton interaction, okay? But what is important, neutron-neutron interaction and proton-proton interaction are not have not sufficient energy to form pions because the relative velocity is not relativistic, right? But neutron-proton interaction, they have a relativistic energy. So you are above the threshold for pion production. That's true. And here you have a collision for each neutrons and protons. You have a collision, okay? And you can create a pion. And you can calculate also the energy of neutrinos that you get out of that, this, and then, okay. And this neutron pion neutron proton collision does not change the number of protons or neutrons.
That's right, that's right.
Okay.
Everything you're saying is right. And
then you can. Oh, sorry.
No, it's right about the neutron proton.
But
the argument for the neutron was that they get heated, and there is always a tail to the Maxwellian distribution, and there will be enough relative velocities. Again, this is the claim, but that was made in writing, and it's a serious consequence if that's right. If it's really right, the claim was there would be enough relative collisions, there would be enough temperature because they would get heated by the same neutron proton collisions as the protons got heated here. And if the neutrons get heated and start colliding with each other, and.
Yeah, but only the tail, I mean, you should only take the tail, okay?
One matter of fitting, I agree. If you have a high energy collision, then the resultant bions have roughly, you know, the set of mass energy. So the neutron's gonna, each neutron is going to, after collision, each neutron is also going to pick up the.
Yeah.
So the question is the cascade is efficient or not?
No,
so
it's not.
It's not.
Mm.
Well, you don't know. You haven't calculated.
Yeah, actually, I did some rough calculation because I was expecting the question. Yes.
If you have more neutrons than protons, like 10 times more neutrons, then this relative motion of protons can add some heat to the neutron component, but not because just protons are not many. So don't heat the neutron component to high temperature. To have these reactions of conversion of neutrons into protons, really need some relativistic.
What do I say? That between neutrons you don't have this. Okay.
I agree with your conclusion, and Fuller et al. Did some rough calculation which also agrees with that, but I think it needs to be done demonstrated because it has been claimed.
No, I didn't also included this process because I checked that energetically is not important. I mean, I checked that the energy that pions and then neutrinos take away is only like a few percent of the total energy. So it's energetic, because here I'm solving everything for adiabatic, under adiabatic assumption, okay? And then I, if I'm not wrong, I checked that the relative neutron-proton ratio wouldn't change much.
I'm glad you did it, and that's good.
Okay.
The claim that was done, was that.
Okay, so let's assume that I'm right. Okay, which is maybe not the case.
Can I see the next slide, please?
Yes. Thank you. No, because I have to finish. No, okay, just. Okay, here heating becomes more important than cooling, so the temperature increases. Okay? And then adiabatic cooling, after this radius, the heating becomes inefficient on the dynamical time scale. And so adiabatic cooling takes over again. Around this radius, we have also that the coupling between electrons and protons becomes inefficient. So the time scale, the Coulomb time scale, is of the order of the dynamical time scale. From this point on, all the heating that protons gain, they take it, they keep it. Okay, so.
And that's the two short stability that's heating it.
It doesn't change much, sorry?
So that second bump.
Exactly, so the first bump is collision, and the second dissipation bump is beta decay. So what's happened here is that protons are faster than neutron, okay? Neutron beta decay into slow proton. And what you have is that they mix rapidly, and the protons are heated, and since their internal energy increases, they are also decelerated.
I got a question. Mm-hmm. You have the neutrons decaying, they're going slower than the protons, so I get this fast proton beam going through a slow cloud of protons. Is the collisional coupling between the slow protons and the fast protons too slow to do the job of transferring the energy to the to have them exchange energy?
So what?
You said that you assumed there was a two-stream instability.
Yes.
Suppose there wasn't.
So why it shouldn't develop?
Never mind. There are lots of reasons why your proton-proton two-stream instability doesn't develop.
Because you have the right condition. You have
it depends a lot on what those.
Okay.
What's
the collision time relative to
what's the collision time?
After decoupling.
After decoupling, the collision time scale is after decoupling the collision, is much less than dynamical time scale. So they are very very rare.
The collisions between protons and neutrons became
negligible.
Okay, but now I've created a new population of protons.
Yes.
So what's proton-proton collision?
The same time scale, so it's the
as
same.
What?
As the neutron-proton collision.
Oh, no, Coulomb.
Right?
Coulomb. Ah,
sorry, Coulomb collision, okay, sorry.
Protons and protons.
Sorry, Coulomb, I was thinking of, sorry.
Forget about the neutrons.
I was thinking about stronger inelastic collision. So, no, it's, if you compare, is very slow, because from this point on, the Coulomb interaction, okay, between electron and protons becomes less than dynamical time scale.
Energy exchange.
Yes.
Energy exchange.
So yes, no. I'm talking about about time scale. Let me think. Okay, so the question here is that the time scale for Coulomb collision between protons is much larger, okay, than the plasma frequency minus one, okay. So if the only way they can exchange momentum and energy is by efficient plasma instability.
I don't believe you. I mean, it really depends on the numbers in the end, but I could perfectly well, I have a beam of fast protons going through a cloud of stationary protons.
Yes.
I can go to a frame.
Yeah.
I'll get a 90 degree deflection time just due to Coulomb scattering.
Yes.
Is that 90 degree slow reflection time longer, yes, large or smaller compared to the dynamical time?
There is longer than the dynamical time scale.
Coulomb scale.
Yes. Yes.
You're sure?
Yes.
By the way, what is the density in this region?
You say it is, so I confirm. No, it is. I can show you. No, it is. Because here. Exactly.
Which is smaller than the mean that you can
use. For proton.
Yes.
Elena, I will leave it up to you, but it's already 3 o'clock. So.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
Again,
okay, so we have a double bump.
But I want everyone to be aware of how much time is.
Yes. So it is, but and so what's happened if I change the Newton fraction? The more Newton you have, the better it is. So you have more heating and more deceleration. And keeping the fraction constant, the less baryon, total baryon I put in. Okay, the larger is the heating and the deceleration, but it's not as dramatic as changing the neutron fraction. And this is all.
Wow. Actually, it was 1 minute to 3 when I made that announcement.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
Yes. So, okay.
So all the way back to the beginning, there was a long conversation about the composition of the jet. What's the ratio of the time scale to come into local equilibrium in the surface layers of the disk relative to the orbital frequency? Is this 10 orders of magnitude, 2 orders of magnitude?
Yeah, it depends on the temperature.
Because I think the relevant comparison isn't to the orbital time scale, it's to the viscous time scale, which could be used. Because you have a blob,
yeah,
long before it either goes into the jet or goes into the hole. It's a viscous time, not an orbital time.
Yeah, but the orbital time scale is the same as the turbulent time scale.
It's turning over many, many, many times. But on average, you ask, how long do you wait before a partial fluid either goes into the hole or goes off into the jet?
Yeah, what?
It has to be a viscous time. Otherwise, if it were shorter than a viscous time,
yeah,
So if we're talking about 10 orders of magnitude, then it doesn't matter. If we're talking about 2 orders of magnitude.
I mean, you're worried that it keeps going up and down before being taken.
And it does that for a viscous time. So is the time scale to come to local equilibrium long compared to a viscous?
So there are three time scales.
Right. Mm.
There are three time scales. One is the longest one is the accretion time scale, which is the viscous time scale. The shortest time scale is the Keplerian time scale, which is the escape time scale of the jet. And the time scale for establishing the equilibrium
is between
the prototype.
So then I'm a little worried.
But the ratio of these longest and shortest time scale, say, R divided by H squared,
alpha,
alpha minus 1. So you've got H over R is 1.2, alpha is 0.1, so you get at least 2 orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
So you're not talking about many orders of magnitude, but rather than a factor of 10, maybe 50.
But the time scale to come into statistical equilibrium falls in between the viscous time and
the calculations. It happens to suggest.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah. Okay.
Why is it a problem?
Because LTE should be established.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is established. No, but
not vertically. No,
yeah. So we have the time scale for LTE is longer than the mixing time scale of this. But it's shorter than
the viscous time scale.
But I think it's the viscous time scale. I don't care about that. No, he's worried about vertical transport. Sure,
yeah.
But consider if it were true that on average material left the disk and went into the jet on a dynamical time scale, then m dot jet over m dot hole
but
would be the ratio.
Yeah,
of the
radially, you establish LTE at
very short.
Exactly. Yes, exactly, exactly. So you care about this because you have the flow.
The vertical transport time has to be very short.
Yes, also because the flow.
Yeah, so the picture is that you have many, many, each piece of material makes many, many, many turns. At some point, some friction could just
escape. Yes. But doing this. But
what will this stuff give us from the point of observation? Because it's unclear what it predicts or what it explains.
Okay, so the first step is always to understand where we are. Right. So
intellectual pleasure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Make your model first, then make a prediction.
Exactly. No. So I show you that at the radii where we think gamma rays are produced, okay, people used to assume a cold flow and a coasting flow. We are seeing now that these conditions are not always satisfied if neutrons are present. So if you want to make your emission process, you should deal with a relative hot flow, then depends on the parameter, and the decelerating variable. And this has implication, for instance, for internal shocks. Okay? And then I can go into detail, but it's better not. So what I want to say is just that the first step, of course, is to compute the dynamic of the fire and thermodynamic, which is the most solid part of the theory that we have. Then you can add your emission process, the one you like, but you should care about those conditions that we are telling you we are in.
So does it have a serious effect on the afterglow? I mean, to get effects on the prompt emission, you have to add more components to the model anyway in order to get internal shocks or kinks and dissipation or whatever. Mm. On the other hand, you've changed the time profile of what the piston is that's driving the external shock. Does that make any difference?
No. Well, for the afterglow. Okay, for the late afterglow, you don't. In this picture, it doesn't. Okay, because whatever is the piston. Okay, then the afterglow comes in a self-similar solution. So you can treat this part for the late afterglow differently. What is changing? Exactly. What is changing here is that if you have neutrons, okay, you don't have only neutrons that beta decay during the early phase, but you also have neutrons that beta decay at the beginning of the afterglow. And this can have observational consequences. And he has worked out this theory.
Can you get the decoupling RNP outside of tau equals 1?
No.
See? No?
No, because of the ratio of the cross section.
So it's not possible that you could never associate this decoupling directly with the gamma ray production?
No.
Because it's always thermal.
Electromagnetic
cross sections,
bigger than
the
cross sections.
Yeah.
Just go back to the picture you showed there.
Too bad.
Just a comment to John.
Which one, sorry?
The previous one, I mean, the canonical one.
The canonical?
Here, that's a good one.
Ah, canonical, great. The standard. This is a classic.
just a comment. If you have a magnetically driven jet, meaning that it's hydromagnetically driven, neutron flow in which jet, the conclusion, the implications can be very different. And in particular, you'll get at decoupling, the protons will go one way and the neutrons will go the other.
Yeah, not at those radii. I don't think you have enough time to decouple.
You'll be decoupling much earlier, and when you decouple, the neutrons will go into a white cone, and the protons are going to collimated cone.
Also, in this early phase, do you have enough time?
Yeah, well, that's the work that Lahakis and Tammy and I did. But
yeah, but so do you have enough? Because I thought it was relevant for the afterglow, but not for this early phase.
Sure. If you're already, means you decouple before you couple.
You decouple. The magnetic field both accelerates and collimates the flow. When you decouple, there's a relative angle between the photons.
Yeah, but since the both go,
the photons continue to collimate and accelerate. So therefore,
but it depends how fast you collimate, because they are both. I mean, you launch.
Always be a relative angle, and you.
Yeah, but it depends how big it is with respect to 1/γ.
So the point is, you decouple much earlier. couple some distances about 2 orders of magnitude. The gamma of the coupling is about 15 rather than 100.
But this, in this region, even if you decouple in this region, you will have always an overlapping between neutrons and protons.
So let me just take this point. Mm-hmm. The original temperature structure at the decoupling region would be fine. I mean, those predictions would be similar, but the second peak, by the time the neutrons decay, the original proton beam would be in a different place in space-time. So they would not
if you have enough time, but but there is no a region in the center in which you have still overlapping between neutrons and protons, and so you have this process going on.
Well, again, I don't want to quibble on details, but I'm talking in large picture. The large scale picture is that the neutrons go in one direction, the protons go along the axis, and so you get very definite implications for the afterglow. You now have the original neutrons would carry most of the energy and create, dominate the afterglow, late afterglow component, the separate component. And that also has been worked out by Peng et al. It's a paper that will be coming up in the June 20th of on the observational implications. So they are very definite predictions, which are distinct from the spherical model, because the argument here is that this
spherical collisions,
the stuff that under it work would not occur. Something else would happen, which is
If you have a large scale magnetic field that collimates the jet, right?
If the jets are collided by hydromagnetic.
Sorry, if you end up having the jet magnetically collimated, you make the neutrons proceed to go off in some direction. When they proceed to decay, they're also in a magnetized region?
No.
They are in the interstellar or intergalactic medium, whatever it may be, but they are not carrying the field along.
It's a
very interesting situation.
Yeah, but but it depends.
Colloquial discussions. So
I can give a talk.
Sure.
Okay.
I'm sure.
I think maybe you're tired of neutrons. You have neutrons and protons.
But what is true is that your result depends on the assumption that the Lorentz factor increases like radius. If you have some collimation, the acceleration is different.
The acceleration is it depends. If you have this is spherical, okay, and this is goes R, okay. If you have collimation, some kind of collimation, okay, this acceleration will be different, but it'll go slower typically, right. No? It goes slower, but all this process will be present.
But
everything will be rescaled, I think. Okay, thank you.